Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Carol DiBenedetto, the chair for the Environment and Natural Resources Forum for tonight. We welcome our listeners on the radio and we invite our audience to visit us online at commonwealthclub.org. It is my pleasure to introduce David Helvarg, who will talk to us about the U.S. Coast Guard today. In addition to his book that he'll discuss with us tonight, Rescue Warriors, the U.S. Coast Guard, America's Forgotten Heroes, David has also authored The War Against the Greens, Blue Frontier, and 50 Ways to Save the Ocean. He will share with us tonight a rare behind-the-scenes look at the distinguished history of America's Forgotten Heroes. He has spent two years, riding on Coast Guard boats, and he will share lots of fascinating stories with us. So it is my pleasure to turn the floor over to David.
Yeah, thank you. It's a little intimidating speaking opposite Patty Duke. Luckily, she didn't bring her identical twins, so I feel less threatened. As Carol mentioned, I spent 2 years riding on Coast Guard boats and in helicopters. I mentioned the helicopters are the ones that actually almost killed me. Last fall, I went out to Hurricane Ike, which was when it hit Texas, the Coast Guard was doing what it usually does, which is get out of the way of the hurricane and then pre-position their resources, their assets, and then just sweep in on the backside of the storm and start saving lives. So I went up to Air Station Sacramento the day it was expected to hit, flew out with a C-130 crew. We landed in Corpus Christi about the same time that the hurricane was making landfall about 160 miles north of us. The next day, you know, already the Coast Guard had saved 90 lives from storm surge. The next day they saved another 100-plus lives, also began to do medical evacuations and pollution assessments and navigation response, where navigation buoys had been blown out of the Houston Canal. As I flew up that day on one of their Falcon jets, we could see the coastline pretty well, not as destroyed as I'd seen it after Katrina, but a lot of stilt houses that were built on the sand on concrete pads that got blown off, and a lot of people who were told to evacuate who didn't, and there were only, I think there would have been a lot more casualties, except the hurricane didn't hit exactly where it was expected to, and God loves fools. As one of the Coasties said, you know, stupidity keeps us working. On the flight back into Corpus, we landed, and we're doing some aggressive maneuvering on the way. There was an overturned boat to check out, and then what we thought was a body in the sand that was actually some marine debris next to a navigation buoy that had been washed up. And when we landed back in the rain in Corpus, the mechanic got out and did his walk around, came back white as a ghost. We'd lost the engine cowling and put all the shrapnel in the tail rotor. So the pilot was like, wow, we're really, really, really lucky we didn't crash. And then he asked me to take his and his crew's picture in front of the copter, of course. And it's a fairly, except for a tendency for the side doors to pop off, the Dolphin, the HH-65, is fairly safe aircraft, except that 10 days earlier, on a training mission, one had gone down off Hawaii, and four of the crew had been killed. And when I got back to the mainland, I was kind of shocked that it wasn't in the national media. I actually wrote that in the introduction. I said that essentially, you know, the least we can expect for people who go in harm's way to help others is that we remember their names. And their names were Thomas Nelson, 42, Andrew Weichmeyer, 44, David Skimmin, 38, and Joshua Nichols, 27. Since last fall, there have been two other Coasties who have been killed in the line of duty. It's a high-risk profession and not very well acknowledged. I think people have a sense that maybe the Coast Guard's out there saving sailors in distress. I don't think they have a sense of what it really is to be a multi-mission maritime agency. that whose area of responsibility is actually the entire blue part of our blue planet, and that they're not only doing search and rescue, but they're doing pollution response, fisheries enforcement. They're doing drug interdiction in the Caribbean and Eastern Pacific, out towards the Galapagos. They're stopping illegal migration by sea, and the range of activities, port security since 9/11, and port safety, both in terms of inspections for safety, both through their active duty personnel, their reservists, and their volunteer auxiliary, which does a lot of boat safety training. And yet, altogether, there are only about 42,000 active duty coasties, which is about the size of the New York Police Department. And yet, every day, they're saving 14 lives, responding to 125 distress calls, plus doing all the law enforcement and military activity they're supposed to be involved in. I just, on the way out, I thought that I could do, I was looking at videos, and if you go on YouTube and look up Coast Guard, it's pretty fun because, of course, all the 20-something coasties have, like, these great, videos they've put together to thrash metal music, with Linkin Park being the most conservative. And then, of course, Thad Allen, the commandant, he's even older than I am, and so he put together a piece that he presented at the annual Coast Guard dinner based on with the background music of It's Your Time by Bob Seger. So there's definitely generational gaps within the service. But I printed out just stories that were from today's Yahoo, just a couple of print stories. The titles are Coast Guard Airlifts Injured Man Off Fishing Boat Near Beach Haven. I think that's New Jersey. Coast Guard Searches for Missing Sailboat. Texas Cleans Up Oil Blobs on South Padre Island. Alaska Search Called Off for Man Overboard. Coast Guard Raises Its Fines in Security Zones. Coast Guard Rescues Two from San Antonio. Learn About Coast Guard Auxiliary Flotilla 1508. Man Dies After Waterway Crash with Boat. Maryland Police Recover Body of Missing 11-Year-Old. Coast Guard cadets involved in engineering competition. Rescuers are searching Chesapeake Bay for missing swimmer. So this is the bread and butter of the Coast Guard, but it's only a small part of it, which is what I came to realize as I worked on this book. I pulled a Coast Guard, the San Antonio guys said they report two San Antonio men rescued 5 miles off the coast of Port Arenas, Texas, Saturday. Received a call approximately 10:50 a.m. from a 911 dispatcher. Had received a call from a man who reported their 26-foot boat. He and another man were aboard. It was taking on water. Coast Guard 45, I think they mean 47-foot response boat and crew from Station Port Arenas was launched, reached the reported position of distress within 15 minutes. No sign of the boat or of the men there. The rescue crew began, and this is very typical. I mean, people sort of forget what a big ocean it is out there. They began to search the area. Shortly after the search began, one of the men fired a red flare, caught the attention of the rescue boat crew. When the rescue boat crew located the men, found their boat was entirely submerged. One was wearing a life jacket, the other holding onto a life ring. Proper safety played a great role in the successful outcome of this case, said Petty Officer Eric Ruhr, the coxswain in the rescue boat. Had these gentlemen not had access to flotation equipment and flares, it may have taken our crew a lot longer to locate them. I got a call from ESPN the other day about, was there something wrong with the Coast Guard? It took them 36 hours to locate these missing football player and his crew off of Florida. I go, wait, they were in an open boat 20 miles offshore. They didn't have an EPIRB, an electronic signaling device. They didn't have any signaling or communications. So I tried to explain how 36 hours is not a long time to find somebody missing in a very large ocean, or even a relatively small ocean like the Caribbean. If somebody's missing or doing wrong on that very large ocean, I think that the Coast Guard are probably the most competent people to find them. I thought maybe I'd just sort of quickly go through the book and give you a sense of the broadness of this organization. And because we're a small group, I'll just try and do it relatively quickly and open it up to questions, because that's generally the easiest way to go. This is, it shouldn't take too long. Let me do a little reading. I'm practicing for when I go to a bookstore. The crew of the fishing boat Maryland pitched and rolled in raging 40-foot seas 85 miles west of Key West. With their controls gone and the vessel threatening to break up, they activated an EPIRB, an emergency position indicating radio beacon buoy, and hoped someone would hear the signal. Tried to launch a life raft, but the storm winds capsized it and dragged it away. All they could do now was hang on, pray for help. At Coast Guard Air Station Clearwater, 210 miles away, their signal was received, and an HH-60 Jayhawk helicopter launched in 40-knot winds around 10 p.m. Soon the big chopper was flying along the leading edge of the storm, blinded by heavy rains, clouds, and darkness, its crew unable to see the ocean rising and falling below them. It would take 3 hours of manhandling their aircraft through buffeting winds and ballistic rain before they finally arrived on scene. A big engine C-130 Hercules from Clearwater was already circling overhead. Unfortunately, the rough track had depleted the helicopter's fuel supply. They only had 15 minutes of fuel left on scene. They could see the Mary Lynn below tossed around in the rolling seas as the crew clung to the stern. Rather than trying to rush things and risk someone being swept away, they decided to head to Key West to refuel. Battling 75-mile-per-hour headwinds in the trip, which should have taken 45 minutes, took 2 hours. They landed at 3 a.m., refueled, were back over the Mary Lynn at daybreak. If anything, the storm had worsened in their absence. Pilot Craig Masello told rescues from McKenyon Bolton that he was not to come off the rescue cable for any reason. This meant the boat crew would have to get in the water to meet him. First hoist wasn't pretty, flight mechanic hoist operator Robert Crane noted dryly. First, they swung Bolton into the stern of the fishing boat, and then as he came free, dangling like bait on a line, he was hit head-on by a monster wave. Still, he managed to get in the water, swim to crew member Anita Miller. He got a quick stroke harness around her, and by then the cable jerked them, dropped the strokes, V-rings, and jammed the hook open. So he replaced the rings, made sure he had a tight grip on her, got them lifted back aboard the helicopter, determined his cable hook, though damaged, was still operable. He went back down for a second hoist. This time, the lifeline from the foundering boat and the second crew member in the water got entangled with the hoist cable, so his support line. This was even less pretty. Were the boat to sink at this point, it could drag the survivor, the rescue swimmer, even the helicopter down with it. While Bolton and the fishermen remaining on the Mary Lynn worked to free the line, a shark 2 or 3 feet long swam through Bolton's legs. I was surprised it was so close to the surface. It made me think twice about what else was out of sight, he told us later. With the lines cleared, he was able to make the second hoist. The third hoist went without a hitch or much of a functioning hook. The entire rescue took around 30 minutes. Rather than fight the winds to Key West, they headed toward Clearwater. With cyclonic tailwinds, they made around 200 knots ground speed. Ridiculous for a helicopter grin co-pilot, Dave Shepard, who, like the rest of the crew, was now riding an adrenaline high. The storm, which had already battered Florida, leaving 6 dead, would continue to pick up strength as it crossed the unusually warm waters of the Gulf of Mexico. The survivors of the Mary Lynn, Mark Gutek, Anita Miller, and Charles White, would be the first three of over 33,000 people to be rescued by the U.S. Coast Guard in the coming days as Hurricane Katrina continued on toward the Mississippi Gulf Coast, New Orleans, and the history books. So this is where I sort of got interested in doing this book. I mean, I've always been interested. I like the ocean. I've lived by it most of my life, and always sort of the orange and white out there. The coasties were out there doing things. Once I was peripherally involved in a rescue behind my cliff house where lifeguards were there, Coast Guard was standing by. Not a lot of interest from any of my agents or publishers over the years. Then I went down after Katrina, and again, I realized this was the only part of government that was functioning. The Louisiana Fish and Game guys and the Coast Guard saved over 33,000 people that week out of less than 60,000 that were saved. And the descriptions, you know, these guys are, there's a sort of professional modesty that doesn't gel well with my own kind of improvised loudness. So these guys had never written up what they did in Katrina until I wrote this chapter, the opening chapter, New Orleans Saints, kind of tracking what they did day to day. And as I said, what they did is what they do very well, which is they cleared out of trouble's way and then came in right behind it. And they responded, you know, with what they call a surge of assets. And what impressed me, a couple of things. One is my background in terms of military reporting and war reporting is when I've had to deal with U.S. military, like the Navy, you put in your request, and it goes up and down the chain of command at the Pentagon, and 6 months later they call you and tell you you're flying or going on the carrier next Tuesday. So I was, you know, going through New Orleans and Plaquemine Parish, which was destroyed, and along the Gulf Coast, which waveland and all these areas that were devastated. And for about a week, I kept calling St. Louis because I heard the Coast Guard District 8 had moved up to St. Louis. Finally, about a week into it, I get through to this lieutenant. I go, you know, I'd like to see the air station south of the city. He says, well, why don't you go down there? I said, well, I thought it's no, just go down to the front gate and ask for whoever's doing public affairs. So I go down there. When I get there, it looks like a combination MASH unit and Woodstock. I mean, everybody's living in trailers and tents, and I get buzzed through, and the public affairs lieutenant commander says, I'm too busy. Go out on the flight line, talk to people, which I did, and was shortly thereafter being offered flyovers of the oil spills in the Gulf. And I realized this is not only a service that trusts its people to act on their own, but also to speak for themselves, and realized that I would have the access that I needed to do the book I wanted to do. And managed to. I mean, as I say, what they did in New Orleans sort of brought them to the attention. They were doing what they do every day, but at the scale they operated, they saved as many people at week as they'd saved in the previous 6 years. And I think the air station there, just their crews, which saved about 1,400 people, was what that air station had saved in 20 years. One of the questions at the end of how they did it is how you create people like this. And I wrote a chapter, The Boot in the Factory, about Cape May, New Jersey, where they train all their enlisted, and the Coast Guard Academy in New London, Connecticut, which is very interesting. And talking with a lot of the young cadets, one of the things I found is a lot of them, you know, if you ask, they're from service families. One of them described them as being from the middle class without money, which I think is what we used to call the working class, but we don't use that language anymore. But a lot of the kids are from service families. They'll say things like, you know, I want to serve my country, but I want to be in a service that saves lives rather than takes them. One said is his dad was a Navy pilot, and he's always wanted to fly, but he'd rather not drop bombs on people. He'd rather pull them off of rooftops. And I think part of why – I think there's basically two reasons. But one is how come there have been more books about Navy SEALs and Marines than the Fifth Armed Service? And I think part of it goes back historically. You know, for thousands of years, we sent our young men off to war, and those who survived came back and became the leaders of our clans and nations. And it was a model that didn't work well, but it worked for a long time. Now we're in a much more crowded and interdependent planet in which the threats aren't just other guys with guns. The threats are from non-state actors. The threats are intentional, like terrorism, accidental, like industrial accidents and disasters and oil spills and chemical incidents, and natural and enhanced natural acts from hurricanes in areas where people are moving to the coast, from Arctic meltdown that's linked to fossil fuel-fired climate change. All these sort of unknowable range of threats on a planet that's two-thirds salt water. And I think the people who are most competent to deal with that unknowable range is the U.S. Coast Guard. Unfortunately, trying to cover 93 million square miles of ocean with 42,000 people isn't a very effective approach. I mean, my conclusion at the end of the book was that you really need to double the size of the Coast Guard in the next 10 years and double it again by 2030 so that you have an organization closer in size and funding to the U.S. Marine Corps than the NYPD. It's not happening. As a result of it's not happening, as you're seeing a gradual decline as the mission sets expand without the resources, you see a loss of competency, or certainly a threat to competency in a number of areas. I mean, it's almost counterproductive. The philosophy of the Coast Guard for almost 200 years is to do more with less. But, you know, as I pointed out to one of their flag officers, the logic of that is you end up doing everything with nothing. In 2001, on 9/11, the Coast Guard evacuated 500,000 people. They coordinated an evacuation of 500,000 people from Lower Manhattan. It's the largest maritime evacuation in history, using workboats, tugboats, and ferries and the like through this, you know, cloud of ash that enveloped the harbor. And they were able, again, a lower-ranking person on his own initiative, shut the harbor down right after the second plane hit, and then they began the evacuation. And the chief of naval operations called the head of the commandant of the Coast Guard at the time, Jim Loy, and said, what can we do for you? And they agreed that bringing Navy warships of war into New York Harbor would scare the public, Coast Guard cutters would reassure them, and so a lot of Coast Guard assets were there on the water. If you look at maps, Coast Guard maps from September 10 and September 12, 2001, it looks like a belt being cinched around the continental United States as they moved assets in and shifted from peacetime to wartime footing. At the time, the Coast Guard had just gone through a decade of funding cuts and was about to face another 10% hit. So what's happened since 9/11 is the funding's expanded. They've gone from a $5 billion to $9 billion organization, but most of that has been around security, has been port security and the development of MIST teams, Maritime Safety and Security Teams, and MSRT, Maritime Safety Response Team, which is like SEALs Light, 200-man unit that's supposed to go out and stop ships that we're not sure have bad guys on them. The problem is, as I say, we don't know. You know, they moved Coast Guard from Department of Transportation to Homeland Security. And luckily, a few of their friends on the Hill, like Senator Collins from Maine, put in Section 888 of the Homeland Security Act that said the Secretary of Homeland Security cannot direct or reduce the multiple maritime missions of the U.S. Coast Guard. Basically, they couldn't interfere, which is why the Coast Guard was able to function after Katrina hit. But they've never been, you know, they've always been an institutional orphan in Washington. I mean, they were created by Alexander Hamilton in 1789. He created the Lighthouse Service, and a year later he created the Revenue Cutter Service. And depending on whether you like lighthouses or wooden ships, their origins go back to those years. And since then they've been under Treasury, under the Department of the Navy, under the Department of Transportation, now Homeland Security. Even though they're a military service, they've never been in the Department of Defense, and so they don't get on that gravy train of high-end defense contractors who, you know, can expand anything that's cost spiraling out of control. Instead, they've sort of made do with 40-year-old vessels and now Jayhawk helicopters that are two-thirds through their lifespan. Instead of 10 hours maintenance for every flying hour, they're now doing 40 hours of maintenance for every hour. And as I say, the missions keep expanding. We're getting more crowded coast. We now have a fifth blue water coast in the Arctic. And in August, they'll be setting up their second annual search and rescue stations in Barrow, Alaska, and security stations at Prudhoe Bay, because shipping's beginning to move in there, people looking for oil and resources. 2 years ago, three cruise ships went through the Northwest Passage without informing the Canadians or the U.S. Suddenly were 400 Germans with, you know, on the beach in Barrow asking where the local Wiener Schnitzel restaurant was. So, you know, incredible range of threats and challenges, a completely under-resourced agency. When the producers from Hollywood who made The Guardian went to where I went, to the swimmer school in North Carolina, they looked at the pool and they said, we can't shoot here. It's too small. It doesn't look realistic. So they went to Shreveport and found a big pool that looked more like what you'd expect rescue swimmers to train in. I watched one of it had started out as a class of 10, and I watched the kid wash out in the pool that day, so it was down to a class of 5. The next day I was talking to them. They were all like, 19, 20, 21-year-old kids. I was explaining how, from what the best available science and scientists have told me, we're going to have more intense Category 4 and 5 hurricanes. It's likely that in their career they'll see another Katrina. One of them goes, that's great. Oh, I didn't mean that, sir. I meant, I know what you mean. You're trained for it. But it's not all, and there's lots of, you know, stories of certainly the rescue swimmers, or, you know, 360 of them who do some incredible saves. Surfmen, which includes a number of women now, who can take a 47-foot boat out in 30-foot seas with 50-knot winds and pull you to safety. The biggest concentration, there are 8 qualified surfmen at Station Golden Gate right at Fort Baker here, which is one of the most active West Coast stations. Between all the they get a lot of the jumpers off the Golden Gate, which, you know, they told me not to talk about that, but of course we started talking about it and the dead sled they use and a lot of windsurfers from Chrissy Field who get pulled out through the gate. And so they have stick pins, and there's lots of black stick pins on the bridge, lots of pink stick pins. between Crissy Field and offshore the Potato Patch, and then you get onto the greens, the foundering boats in the Potato Patch. And you know, as you get further out toward the Farallones, it gets weirder. One of the rescue swimmers was telling me they used to train until last year at the Sea Buoy, which is halfway to the Farallones, and they threw out SpongeBob. I wasn't on that one, but you know, they have this cushion thing that's supposed to be a drowning person. They threw him in the water, and they had the swimmer halfway down the cable, and the pilot says, "Wow, something really big just took SpongeBob." They reeled him back in, and I was on another rotation with this swimmer. I go, "So what do you think?" He says, "Yeah, my favorite station was Air Station Detroit. He says, fresh water, no sharks." But again, an amazing organization doing lots of things that nobody knows about. Even I didn't know the aids to navigation function. During last winter's big storms, I went out on the Aspen, which Dirty Jobs had just shot them pulling. They pull up all the navigation and weather buoys, clean them up. When they get displaced, they correct them. They went 99.6% of 6,000-plus major navigation buoys functioning so people can get in and out of harbors and know what the weather's like. And we went out. The captain thought we were, you know, in this window between storm fronts, which we weren't. So we're sort of mucking around in 20-foot seas for 2 days until, you know, the mud flow out of Humboldt Bay finally cleared and we were able to go in and switch out the buoy there. But this is the sort of, you know, it's a diversity. You know, you got these guys and gals who love black hulls, the buoy tenders, and spend their whole careers in aids navigation. Other people switch around. They go from LEDA teams, law enforcement detachments, riding on Navy ships, and when they're about to take down a drug runner, Navy doesn't like to mention this, they have to raise the Coast Guard ensign and make it a Coast Guard ship because the Coast Guard is both law enforcement and military. The rest of the military is not allowed to do law enforcement in the Posse Comitatus, but the Coast Guard's missions have just sort of grown over the centuries. Pretty much anything having to do with water, navigable water, be it salty, brackish, or fresh, they're there. And so, you know, it's an amazing diversity and impressed me both as a water person and also just the sense of what drives these people. A real sense, mix of patriotism, altruism, and adrenaline. I was up on in Kodiak, Alaska last winter and on the Monroe, which is a big 378-foot high-endurance cutter. They just moved up there. And Bark Lloyd, the captain, was saying he asks all his new folks who come on board what their parents do. This is a really high percentage, like over 10% say their mother's a professional nurse. So he says, so he figures that, you know, here you have somebody who's raised in a family with a professional nurturer, and they want to do that, but they also want the adventure. And so Coast Guard provides that. A month after I was there, the Monroe was out with its helicopters. A big last Easter at night, a big factory trawler went down, the Alaska Ranger. And most of the fishermen on board, they got in their survival suits. They couldn't get in the raft. So in 20-foot seas at night, they managed the Monroe. The Coast Guard managed to coordinate a rescue effort 400 miles off Dutch Harbor where 42 out of 47 people were saved. And I've been in there, you know, in their SAR centers and their command centers in Hawaii and Seattle and elsewhere where they've coordinated rescues off of Guam, 400 miles off of Guam, coordinated out of a rescue center in Hawaii. So, you know, the stretch is global. They're also there training people and protecting resources around the world. One of the other functions out of Kodiak is fisheries patrols in the Pacific. They helped end the high seas drift net fleet that used to have 1,000 boats out there putting 40,000 miles of net every night. And part of it was, and Greenpeace and other folks were out there pointing out that they were also destroying the ecosystem of the North Pacific, that they were catching billfish and small whales and seabirds by the hundreds of thousands. There wasn't a lot of interest. And then fish cops, NOAA investigators found out that there was a lot of illegal salmon. And there's a treaty between the U.S., Russia, Japan, and Canada that you don't take salmon at sea. You wait for them to return to their natal rivers. So word got out. A sting was set up on the high seas. They went out there. This is in 89. And they were going to buy 100 tons of hot salmon for like $2 million. And as the pirate captains were coming on board, the Morgenthau, one of the Coast Guard high-endurance cutters, came over the horizon with its klaxons ringing and two C-130s dropped out of the clouds, dropping flares, and the pirates tried to flee. They threw their nets overboard to try and, you know, foul the props on their pursuit. And eventually, the Morgenthau had to go across the ocean, 40 miles off Taiwan. The Taiwanese government finally gave him permission to board. And, of course, there was tons of illegal salmon, hundreds of millions of dollars of U.S. salmon being stolen. And once you could attach a dollar value, the first President Bush worked with the Australians and the New Zealanders, and eventually the U.N. banned these high seas drift nets. And, you know, and it was one of the great conservation success stories. If you can ban one type of fishery that's destroying the ecosystem, there's no reason you can't ban bottom trawling or the factory trawlers that operate today. And where they've turned pirate, the Coast Guard now goes out with Chinese FLEC, Chinese Fisheries Law Enforcement members, boarding Kodiak, and they get out in the mid-Pacific. They find one of these pirate drift netters. They get on the radio, and the Chinese say, "We're Chinese national. You have no right to board us." And they say, "Well, here, talk to your law enforcement guy." And they put the Chinese law enforcement in there on board a few minutes later. Same with drug deals they've cut with the Colombians, the Ecuadorians. You know, the drug boats go out around the Galapagos with go-fasts, and they have fishing vessels acting as their gas stations. But once you have these bilateral agreements, you can drop off a Navy ship at night, get on a rigid hull inflatable so they don't see you on radar, go 20 miles over the horizon and do a nighttime boarding of these vessels. Anyway, so if you're, you know, 20-something, there's a lot of opportunity to have your adrenaline express itself in various ways. But like I say, as you look at the larger mission, it actually is a mission that serves the taxpayer, serves the public. 14 lives a day saved in a response to 125 incidents. And so like I say, a sea service that mainly saves lives rather than taking them, what's not to like? You know, plus gave me an excuse. I went with them off the coast of Iraq where they're guarding oil terminals to here in Richardson Bay where they were looking at the impacts of the oil spill we had here. You know, as I say, it's unfortunate people know, the public knows so little about them, because the only way they're going to grow to the scale to meet the challenges of our world today is if they have public support. And hopefully part of what this book can do is create that support. So thank you, and I'll take questions.
We'd like to remind our listening audience that this is a program with the Commonwealth Club of California, and you're listening to a program entitled The U.S. Coast Guard Today. Joining us today is David Helvarg speaking to us about his book, Rescue Warriors, The U.S. Coast Guard, America. Forgotten Heroes. Our thanks to David for speaking to us tonight. Questions? Who has a question? I have a question. What scale, you talked about the scale, it went up to $9 billion budget. Do you think that's enough? Or what do they think there should be in terms of resources for the Coast Guard?
They've got about, well, I went to a Naval Institute conference where they had the sea services talking about maritime strategy for the 21st century, and they had Mike Mullen, who was head of the Navy then, chief of naval operations, he's now chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the head of the Marine Corps, and Thad Allen, who's head of the Coast Guard now. And when the Marine Corps guy got up, he said, you know, speaking as the leader of the smallest of the armed services, and I saw Thad Allen just sort of sitting there quietly, the Marine Corps has 5 times the personnel and 10 times the budget of the Coast Guard. I think in terms of mission sets, whether it's training, most of the world's navies are closer in size to the Coast Guard than the Navy, and the Coast Guard has a image with its white hulls that makes it very accessible to reach out. And as we face this range of threats from food security and the decline of marine wildlife, the loss of 90% of the big fish in the ocean since 1950, for example. We need the Coast Guard both to be expanding its enforcement, also to train other nations to protect their resources. We're always, you know, we don't know, as I say, if we'll ever see a dirty bomb in America. We know there'll always be another hurricane season. And the security sets blend very well with the safety issues, and so, you know, I think $9 billion is peanuts compared to what the other services have. You know, you're looking at the Navy budget tends to be about 15 times the size of the Coast Guard's, 15 to 20. And the Navy's very good at one, I mean, for speed and lethality. If you want to, you know, kill people from a marine environment, call the Navy. But if you want to make sure that, that our global shipping is safe, both from a security point of view and in terms that it's not dumping oily waste every mile that it travels, if you want to prevent or respond to oil spills or chemical hazards or explosions in our ports, if, you know, if you want to make sure that terrorists don't blow up an LNG tanker in Boston Harbor, or if you just want to do small boat operations. When I was in Iraq, we were boarding Iraqi fishing dhows, and one of the Navy guys had asked one of the coasties, he says, well, what can you teach us? He says, well, I did 600 boardings at my last post in New Hampshire. How many have you done? And, of course, the Navy hands out candy when they board, as you know, and the Coast Guard hands out, you know, flotation devices and flares because they deal mariner to mariner. And they have this, you know, ambidextrousness in that they're both able to talk to the Navy and able to talk to first responders, to local fire boats and mariners on the docks and others. So, yeah, they're you know, in terms of the dollar return to the taxpayer, it's up there with, you know, with water treatment plants and the post office and 4th of July fireworks, but it's only got so much to where it starts to break down, and I think it's at that point.
Okay. I have some friends who are, a couple friends who are retired Coast Guardies, and they've told me that the morale's gone down since the Coast Guard went into Homeland Security. Did you find any of that in your travels with them?
No, actually, it's sort of mixed. I find that certainly at the flag level, you know, with the admirals, they're very happy to be there because in Department of Transportation, they've always been a mismatch, but in DOT, they were always, you know, they had about as much influence as Amtrak. I mean, all the lobbying and money was around the highway bill, and the FAA and the air traffic industry was in there. Now they're sort of a big fish in a dysfunctional pond. But I do, I think, you know, the guys, I mean, I've got a chapter called Gunners, and certainly the guys on the law enforcement and counter-terror side love it. They've gone, one of them told me that, you know, we're all as the bridesmaid, now we're the bride. And, you know, I said, well, that's not a very macho analogy, but I'll take what you mean. But I think, you know, they, my own, in the last chapter, I mean, my own feeling is, and it's not my own feeling, two ocean commissions in 1969 and 2003 proposed the U.S. create a Department of the Ocean. I think that, you know, in terms of where they would fit, the Coast Guard and NOAA, the National Oceanographic Atmospheric Administration, which Nixon sunk in the Department of Commerce, if you took Coast Guard out of DHS and NOAA out of Commerce and added some additional shops from State Department Interior, you'd really have something that would match our last great frontier. And it's interesting, when I talk to some in the Coast Guard headquarters, they sort of nod and smile. It's not politically realistic at the moment, but it is, I think, what would best serve the public interest.
Hi. I'm wondering how the Coast Guard overlaps its power with, say, the Navy and the police and the city and so forth. And my question has to do with the Hurricane Ike. And I had been in Galveston a few months before the hurricane hit in a big four-bedroom, four-bath house that had beds and chairs and pillows and refrigerator and a stove and a whole house and deck chairs. And all of that is gone. I don't know where it went. And I can't figure it out. I mean, it doesn't make sense. That whole front row and the second row of Galveston, which is an island, is gone. And am I going to go swimming someday down in Galveston and run into a refrigerator? I mean, where did all that stuff go? Some of it went down to Corpus Christi, which is 600 or 800 miles away. And who is responsible for cleaning up all the trash that is left behind by these hurricanes, because some of it probably ended up on that little spit of land that's Galveston, some out in the Gulf of Mexico, and some on the bay between Galveston and the mainland.
Cleanup's a huge problem. The Coast Guard's mainly responsible for responding to the oil spills, like 500,000 gallons spilled after Ike, and restoring the navigation channels, the navigable waters. State and federal funds from FEMA are supposed to go into response. When I was there after Katrina, they targeted, you know, they figured 70,000 tons of waste product, which they tried to break up into white trash being refrigerator stoves and all, first starting with woody products down trees, then going to timber, white waste, plastics, and it's a long process. Yeah, a lot of it is underwater now. There are shrimpers. The 10% of the shrimp fleet in Louisiana survived. Has spent the last 5 years pulling up refrigerators and insulation, and one got lucky and pulled up an ATM. Well, FEMA is supposed to do part of it in collaboration with the states. As I say, the Coast Guard comes in with their strike teams that are regional, and they're supposed to target the direct pollution, chemical and oil pollution, and also, you know, keeping the waterways open by reestablishing navigation buoys, and they'll deal with obstructions, threats to navigation. The bigger wasteland that I saw along the Gulf Coast, a lot of that's still cleaning up. I mean, it's amazing. I remember I was down on the beach in Biloxi, and it's just, you know, when you blow up thousands of houses, how much plastic ends up on the sand, and I was, like, watching all these birds pecking at, you know, styrofoam pellets, and I felt like a complete eco-geek because I was worrying about the wildlife while everybody else was wondering when the casino barges would reopen to jumpstart the economy. But, there's attempts through DHS to do more collaboration. It's got new leadership, and maybe it'll get more functional in the next few hurricane seasons.
We had a Coast Guard cutter return to the Bay Area, I believe, in the last 1 or 2 weeks from Somalia pirate escorting. And I was kind of amazed that the U.S. Coast Guard was over there on that duty. How much do you know? How much of the resources of the Coast Guard has been devoted to that?
Well, there have been, right now, there are about 300 coasties in Bahrain who are doing duty guarding Iraqi oil terminals off of there. There are LIDA teams, these law enforcement detachments that, when they're not doing drug interdiction in the Pacific or Caribbean, are off Somalia doing operations there. They train the Navy guys on boardings and small boat boardings, anti-piracy patrol. Before they were doing anti-piracy, I have a story in the book, in 2005, they're working with the Navy SEALs and CIA, interviewing mariners off the coast of Somalia because of reports of an al-Qaeda training camp on shore. And there was a German vessel as well. And at one point, they were called in. They thought they were going to do a hostile boarding, so they were all armed up with M4s. And they got there, and they saw this big shipload of Somali refugees trying to make it to Aden. And you think how desperate you got to be if you're willing to risk your life to get to Aden. And they tried to, you know, and of course the coasties took off their armor and got in small boats, and the Germans wouldn't take them on, so they ordered them to turn around. As soon as they tried, it was a totally unbalanced boat. As soon as it tried to turn, everybody was in the water. And I've got, you know, footage of it. It's pretty amazing. They managed to save about 80 out of 100 some odd people there. And a lot because even though they were doing law enforcement, these coasties were also experienced from the Caribbean, dealing with Haitian and Cuban migrants, and knew what to do. And, you know, like I say, if you want to shoot them, the CIA would have been good. But to save them, it was good to have the coasties there. But they are stretched thin. I mean, they had this terrible contracting deal where the first 7 boats built for them by Northrop wouldn't float. And this is in 2007. They had to decommission 7 of these 123 footers. And at the same time, their best 610 footers are over there, have been over there in Iraq since 2003. And as one of the Coast Guard sector commanders here told me, he says, so we've got our best assets off Iraq. Does that mean that we've attained homeland security?
Hi. On average, how long does it take an EPIRB signal to reach the Coast Guard station that's going to launch the rescue?
It depends where it is. I mean, the first satellite pass by, which can be anywhere from, you know, 1 minute to hours, sends a bar, and apparently the bar has two signals at both ends. So you have to, you know, if you're in the middle of the Pacific, you don't know which end to go to, and so you wait 12 hours for the next satellite pass by, which is what happened, like, when this Chinese timber ship went off, down off Guam, sank. And they had, you know, they had naval intelligence that something was there, but they waited 12 hours to confirm that that's where. On the other hand, you know, if the EPIRB bar is right off the coast of Jersey, you figure out which end to go to, if, you know. But as I say, it can be, I mean, you know, normally the response is pretty quick and there are other assets and communications in play. But it can be anywhere from, you know, 8 to 24 hours to you know, if it's out in the far ocean. One of my projects in the intro, I talk about how my environmental project was rescued by my book project. When Roz Savage she's in the South Pacific rowing a rowboat across the ocean to raise environmental awareness. But her first launch from here, she got about 8 hours out. And she, I mean, 8 days out, 150 miles offshore, capsized three times, lost her sea anchor and didn't want to use her EPIRB, didn't want to signal. But she was talking with her comms people, and somebody ratted her out to the Coast Guard. They came out, put a swimmer on. I talked to the pilot. He goes, "You're a friend of hers?" I go, "Yeah." This is an interesting woman. He says, on the way back, she kept complaining how this other woman had, like, capsized 12 times in the Atlantic, and she felt like a wimp only capsizing three. And I said, "Well, ma'am, Roz, it's a bigger ocean out here." Dave?
Yeah, just to follow up on the EPIRB question, there's some newer technology, Find Me Spot, It seems to be in real time. Is there something about coastal satellite or GPS response versus the EPIRB?
I don't know. I know they've got Rescue 21, which they're moving into different areas, which is sort of like LORAN's was imagined to be, that it can triangulate immediately onto any signal. Mm-hmm. And I think that's now in, like, 12 ports, and that, you know, at a certain point, I start getting fuzzy when they get into the electronic details. Yeah. But within range of like a dozen major ports, they have, you know, they don't have to wait on EPIRB. If they get the signal, they can locate you through a Rescue 21 signals, which use an array of different locations to narrow down figures. On the other hand, if, you know, you put in a report that, you know, this guy left this marina yesterday and we haven't seen him, not going to help. I mean, I was over the Caribbean in one of their Falcons, and they have all the FLIR, the forward-looking infrared. We got a signal. We flew over something, and there was, like, some light, and they tried the FLIR, and they did four passes over it, and all you got was sort of lines and squiggles, and there was no flares. There was no radio comms. They finally went down to 50 feet with all their lights on. Never figured out what it was. Called it into the, you know, the boat station in Key West, and low on fuel, went back to Miami. So it's big, strange ocean. People just don't understand. This is like, space is a lot easier to handle. It's just a vacuum. This is like, you know, a unbreathable liquid medium that's, you know, full of currents and upwellings and you know, ranges of possibilities, the ways that it can kill you without consciousness.
Questions? More questions?
I don't have a question, just a statement. I just wanted to thank you for shining the light on the work that the Coast Guard does. I'm a Coast Guard wife 18 years so far, and just thank you very much for your advocacy.
Thanks. And actually, well, maybe you could answer questions. Somebody, I was on radio yesterday, and they said, "Well, what about families?" And I said, "Well, I thought it was better than the other services because you work where you live, and even though you move around as a family." I mean, is that
In some cases, that's true, but in many cases, it's like every other military service. We do move a lot, and our husbands or spouses are away a lot of the time. Mm.
It's rough. I mean, it's definitely a sacrifice and a trade-off, and the one advantage, one of the guys who was a helicopter pilot transferred to the Coast Guard, he goes, well, you know, the difference is in the Army, I was either in Iraq or Texas. Here, I'm always on the water, and I like the water.
Thank you. I don't know if you can answer this or not, but you seem to know everything else. Every time I drive along Highway 89 by Lake Tahoe, I see this signpost pointing that says Coast Guard Station. What do they do there?
Well, you know those really nice mahogany motorboats that they can tow them. And, if you have a hardship duty like Bahrain, which I didn't find a hardship at all, but or like a Loran station on St. Paul in the middle of the Aleutian Sea, then your sort of dream sheet, your next assignment you get to ask for. A lot of them ask for Lake Tahoe. But they're also in, every summer, they're also in Lake Havasu during spring break, just making sure that drunken college kids don't drown themselves. People don't realize it's really all navigable water, that there's this whole inland Coast Guard. And like the surf stations, it's mostly run by enlisted and operating all up and down the Mississippi and into Kentucky and Indiana and, lots of places you don't think of the Coast Guard.
I have a quick question. So I'm curious about reimbursement when someone gets saved that did something really dumb. So say they're out on the water and they shouldn't be surfing in some crazy conditions and the save gets made. Is there payment expected?
No, it's your tax dollars at work. And periodically, Congress periodically says, oh, we'll save money, we'll charge for rescues. And the Coast Guard has always opposed this on the principle that if you're going to be charged for your rescue, you're going to wait longer, mm-hmm. and you're going to put yourself and your rescuers at greater risk because you're going to think. And on the other hand, I was at Golden Gate Surf Station. There was this foundering sailboat off of Pillar Point down by Moss Beach. And this was a day with, 18 to 20-foot seas. And he got on the radio, and he asked about, commercial tows, and the Coast Guard was there and ready to go, and he opted for the commercial tow for $3,000. I asked one of the guys, well, why do you think that is? He says, I don't know, maybe he's got something on board he doesn't want us to see, but I'm happy not to, do a 12-hour tow if I don't have to. But if they have to, they will. That's the thing of it. But, yeah, it's a bad idea to charge for saving people because then they'll be more reluctant to call in for help when they need it.
This is about collaboration. When we had the Costco Busan oil spill in the bay, a lot of people in their private boats wanted to help and do some things. And, what is their policy for collaboration? I know that was a toxic spill of sorts, but in other kinds of search and rescue, do private boaters get involved? Do they have an auxiliary or anything like that?
Yeah, they. On my duck scrubber chapter, I talk about how they basically screwed up on the Costco Busan response, but they did commission a study by outside sources, including like San Francisco Baykeeper and others. It was interesting when I was going around the country later on, like to Hurricane Ike with the strike team there. They'd all read that report. They were not happy that they didn't do a good job, and it's a learning organization. In terms of now they had trained up local commercial fishermen, and that program had defunded, and they weren't trained up the state, the Coast Guard, and the contractors had all basically let the resources decline. In terms of collaboration, in search and rescue, they have what they call Good Samaritans. And they're always looking for Good Samaritans. When Ross was in trouble, they have a program that's like the ANVR, which is sort of like the Amber Alert, only for big commercial ships, which will come to the aid of other ships in trouble. And they're always, you know, they're looking for Good Samaritans. They have a, now they have a an American Waters watch where they're working with people to look for suspicious activities in ports and dock areas. And, of course, they have like a 30,000-member auxiliary, which does a lot of the boat safety training for the public. And they also have boats and aircraft that they use to supplement this underfunded federal agency. You know, the answers are really mostly in this book, and it's a pretty good read,
exactly.
I'm told.
Well, our thanks to David for leading this discussion tonight, and thanks to you, the audiences, and the audience on the radio as well. So this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of America, leading 103 years of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.